Okay, so it is part two of this week's Echo Chamber, and we have got a really interesting, it's like, it's fiction, but it's based on reality and improv, and oh man, it's really interesting. So we've got that, and then a conversation with the lady behind it. So people, get ready for another fun ride. Okay, so people, let's get into it. Here is my take on Steven. Okay, so Modern Films hooked me up with this new, really interesting, I don't know what you call it, film, it's a documentary. It's called Steven, right? It is directed by Melanie Manshott, who also came up with the story and this crazy concept of putting this together. Lee Campbell actually wrote the script. It's produced by Eleanor Hill, executive produced by Fatos Ustek and Saul Papadopoulos, and Melanie Manshott co-produces. Forest Swords handles the music, right? Bevis Bowden, Roger Chapman, and Andrew Schoenfelder handle the cinematography. Graham Hanks and Lisa Ryan Carter are on editing duties. Stephen Ora, production design. Sidon Roberts, costume design. Hair and makeup, we have Anoy Negro. And our cast. Well, Stephen Giddens plays Thomas Good and himself. Yep, I know. Kent Riley plays his brother Paul Gould. We have Sarah, Thomas's girlfriend, played by Paisley Reed. There's Max, played by Michelle Collins, and Frank, played by Michael Stark. So the gist, right? A combination of narrative fiction with real-life observation, interviews, and archive material. It takes the form of a film within a film, inspired by a famous Mitchell and Kenyon movie held at the British Film Institute Archive, Arrest of Gould, 1901, the first ever crime reconstruction, and the very first film produced in Liverpool. The film takes us on an intimate journey with two characters as Stephen Giddings, the film's main character, auditions for and takes on a role in a movie produced with a mixed cast of people in addiction recovery alongside four professional actors. The work presents alternative perspectives on urgent social questions, including alcohol, drug misuse, gambling, and mental health. As fiction merges with reality, the separation between person, actor, and character begins to dissolve, and the lines between what is real and what is fabrication starts to blur. So, it is such an interesting piece, this. It is like fascinating, because we see him at the beginning, right, sitting in this dark room. Well, we have this black and white image on screen, and then we see a guy sitting there in this dark room watching it. And I had no clue that was an actual film, right? The first crime reconstruction. I don't know why that was so difficult. Oh my days. But yeah, it was the first, right, depicting this guy, which is fascinating, right? Just it's kind of crazy, you know. We're telling this story of this person that, yeah, not the best, yeah. Like this real guy, Thomas Gould, worked as a bank clerk, right? But was addicted to gambling. So he took money from the bank, and got caught. All right, got caught and ended up going to debtor's prison to serve hard labor for 10 years, which I know those workhouses and all of that, yeah, not meant to be the best, right? I don't think anyone would choose that, but yeah, that's what happened. And so this film is capturing that, right? It's giving us a reinterpretation of that story in modern day, but then blurring it with all this other stuff. So we see Stephen Giddings going for auditions to play Thomas Gould. And, you know, so you're cutting between that, right, the scenes in the pub, and you're like, oh, is this after the audition? No, this is the film, right? So we see the audition, and then we see bits of this film being made. So it's just all like, yeah, this real blurred lined kind of thing. Now, tonally, right, we do get this shift, you know, the visual hues of the film. So Munchant, yeah, she does this thing with that, which kind of, you know, gives you this understanding. We oftentimes see, like, Giddings change his clothes, right? So, you know, that old adage, clothes maketh the man, right? So we see, literally, we see Stephen walking and changing, you know, becoming Thomas. Or maybe it's the other way around, right? So we see all of this, but we also then have these recovery sessions. Recovery sessions, like AA type of thing, these groups, everyone's sitting around talking, right? Talking about addiction, talking about that thing. At one point, this woman says, you know, I hate labels, right? I hate being thought of as an addict. I'm more than that, right? And this other guy's like, yeah, but you're an addict. You know what I mean? Why? You can't hide that. You can't deny that. And I think it's an interesting thing, right? Because, I mean, there are levels of addiction, right? There are functioning addicts. There are people where it completely consumes them and destroys them. I mean, it will destroy you eventually. Some people can ride it a lot longer than others. And you can say, yeah, you know, you have these other aspects of yourself. But I think with things like addiction, it's something that can destroy your life. So you are judged by that, right? We're judged by these important kind of things, those dominating factors of ourselves a lot of the time, and addiction is one of those. But you just hear all of these different people talking about like these different forms of addiction, whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol, gambling. I mean, you know, there's so many different types, right? So we hear all of this. We also hear Stephen talk about suicide, right? And mental health. And it's just, it's kind of unrelenting, because you're seeing, you know, this Thomas Gould character, like, doing all of this stuff. And then we're hearing Stephen talk, and we're seeing the AA sessions and the other interviews and things. So we are being waterboarded with all of this stuff. It's important stuff, though. It's important stuff, right? And I think it brings it home. It really brings the you know, the severity of this, right? How it can just completely ruin you, right? So with Thomas, it's the gambling, right? People, they gamble, they're up, but we've got to keep on going, raise the stakes. That's crazy, right? It's crazy. And you just think, walk away. Can't you walk away? But no, they're addicted. They're chasing that high. Or they think, all right, I might have lost, but I can win that back, right? That was a fluke. I don't usually lose. I'll win the next one. Or I'll win the next one. I mean, you know, I wasn't focused before. Now I'm focused. I'm going to win. And so that's what we get. Right? You see someone, you know, he's got a girlfriend. She's pregnant. They're talking about moving in. You just see all of this stuff, these good, positive things happening in his life. It's not enough. You know what I mean? It's not enough. We hear Stephen talk about, you know, this suicide attempt. We hear him talk about his, you know, relationship with his family and his dad and mom, and just all of these different things. And there's this rawness to it. There's this rawness to it, which just brings it home, really does. On top of all of this, we have this dancer as well, which I don't know why. I don't know why she's there, but it is visually striking, right? Like, with all of this other stuff that is happening, and then you have this woman doing these movements, and it's kind of like, I don't know, that little break from all the other stuff that you're hearing and you're seeing. So I don't know why. I don't know why. I don't know what the choice was, but yeah. You know, there's something about it. There's something about it. This is, it's just such a fascinating film. It's such a fascinating film, because it's just, you know, these two different stories, but with this connective tissue. And one of these stories is real. You know, I mean, they're both real. Right, I think that's, well, I think there's reality in both, right? But Thomas Gould actually happened. That's a thing, right? So it's a fascinating thing. It's also an art installation, right? There's an art installation happening in Cornwall, right, in the, oh, what's it, the place is called The Escape, I believe. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, people. I think you don't have to have been affected by any of the things mentioned in this film, I would say, to just be captivated by it. You know what I mean? I think it's just gonna, it will grab you regardless. Because the acting is very good. It's very good acting from everyone involved, you know? So you have this great acting, but then these themes, right? These themes that are just so universal. You know, they, as I said, they might not have happened to you, but chances are you know someone that has been affected by this. So it's just, yeah. It is, whew. Yeah, so there's an installation happening at Liverpool Biennial. And yeah, in Cornwall as well. But it's going to get its general release on the 26th of April. So I highly do recommend checking out Stephen, because it's just a fascinating visual journey, right? Fascinating. Just the way it's put together, the way it's shot, the construction. It's impressive. It's impressive. All around, you know, the acting, you know, script, direction, cinematography. Yeah, it's great. So, yeah, Stephen, out on the 26th of April. And now, as promised, we get to hear from the woman who put this together, director, writer, creative genius, award winner, so many accolades. People, it's time to hear from Melanie Manchot. Okay, people, so I am joined by Melanie Manchot. Is that right?
Yes, it's right. It's pronounced slightly differently, Manchot. It's a complicated French name.
Okay, Manchot. Okay, Melanie Manchot, the director of Stephen, which I watched it this morning. So interesting. Such an interesting piece. I really enjoyed the way you decided to tell this story. Like, how did this idea and concept come to you?
So the film has quite a long backstory and was in the making for a fair number of years. The backstory really is that I met Stephen, who is the titular protagonist of the film, who literally is in every single scene, about 11 years ago in January 2013, when he first came into recovery at a recovery center in Liverpool. And at the time, he was super young, and young particularly in the sense of someone going into recovery in their mid-20s. That's quite unusual. And in Stephen's case, rather than it simply being a matter of consumption of alcohol or drugs, it was more really a mental health issue that he was battling with and that he needed to address. And that obviously he talks about quite eloquently in the film itself. And we started working then through a series of workshops towards a previous piece of work called 12, where I worked with 12 people in addiction recovery. And the moment I started working with Stephen, the moment there was a camera in the room and the camera turned on, it was like this kind of incredibly charismatic, empathetic stage presence emerged. He was like in front of the camera, he shines and he captivates people, and he was definitely captivating me. And so then through a number of, you know, without going into all the details, he ended up in drama school. 2 years later, he was actually leaving drama school, not because he didn't enjoy it. He loved it and he really kind of wanted to pursue it. But he felt, look, I'm a young man from an estate. Most of my family has been wiped out by various forms of addiction and illness. It's not going to happen, you know. I mean, it's a dream, but a dream is a dream. And what can I, you know, how am I going to move forward with my life? like many, many people who come out of addiction and are in recovery, he wanted to also use his experience to do some good in the world and decided to study to become a mental health nurse. So many, that's, you know, it runs through many, many addiction stories that they, once they're in recovery, use their experience to help others. And addiction is all about, and recovery is all about one person helping another person. That's another story. So at the time when he said, look, I'm, you know, this becoming an actor, yeah, I would love to, but it might never happen. But if only once in my lifetime, I was able to act in a film, like a proper film, like a, you know, like a fiction feature, and I could show the world what I've got to give. And then either something comes from it and you know, it progresses, or if not, then at least I've had the experience and I can lay it to rest. And on that day, I said to Stephen, okay, I'm going to write that film. And I meant it very seriously, even though, you know, it then took a good 7 years to come to fruition. So to come to the film itself, I then very quickly went into research mode. So most of the work I do is very heavily researched. I love location research. It's quite often informed by the geography of a location, its cultural background, its history. And Stephen is very much from Liverpool. And I'd made a lot of work in Liverpool before with this group of people in recovery. So it was very clear to me from the beginning that the film would be set in Liverpool. I researched films that come from Liverpool and very quickly came across a film from 1901 called The Arrest of Goody. It's made by Victorian filmmakers Mitchell and Kenyon. And is the first crime reconstruction in the world and the first film ever made in Liverpool. And he thinks, so what happened in this film? Well, in this film, someone gets arrested for embezzling £170,000 from the Bank of Liverpool. That's a lot of money. That's 22 million in today's money. And then he very quickly asks himself the question, what happened to all this money? He was a gambling addict. And he goes, wow, I mean, that's like a gift from heavens. I'm working with someone who comes from a background of substance addiction and alcoholism, not just in himself, but also in others. He's got an enormous amount of experience with addiction issues. And his first film ever made in Liverpool is about addiction, but a different addiction, gambling.
Mm.
So I then set out to rewrite this Victorian film to near contemporary times, wrote a story arc, wrote the kind of ideas for the film. And then it became clearer and clearer to me that the film wasn't going to be just a sort of straightforward gangster fiction, a sort of genre film, but that I wanted it to be more complex. And not just for the sake of it, but I wanted it to have Stephen's real life in it, because his real life is extraordinary. And he tells the stories from his life with such clarity, but also with such empathy. And I think it's incredibly useful for people to hear him speak about his life. So I wanted his real life to be there and his real life to inform the fiction. And maybe even that could be a feedback between the fiction and his real life. I also wanted the archive film to be there. So when you see the film, Stephen, you get all three. You get these three modes of storytelling. You get the archive film, you get a documentary framework that is both his real life, but also him going into the fiction. And then you're in the fiction and you dive into this fiction story. So that's the shape of the film.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, it's, but yeah, I didn't know the first film we're seeing is this real archival footage.
Yeah.
Right. So it's fascinating. Now, when you decided, okay, it can't just be a traditional film, how long then did it take to kind of construe this new structure to be like, okay, we'll start off with the archival and then we'll just go in between these two kind of worlds? Like, how did that idea come to you?
So the idea came, I mean, partly it's probably informed by the fact that I come from a background in visual art. And so I didn't go to film school. I studied at art school. And I think that there is a subtle difference between the kind of references that we use coming from an art background compared to those coming from a film background, or how conceptually tight we tend to kind of construct our work. And I wanted there to be this multiplicity of languages, partly because I really felt it was important when talking about addiction to disrupt a sort of linear story, because addiction is not linear. If there's one thing that I've learned over the now 12, 13 years of having worked with addiction on and off as a subject matter, is that anyone who's ever experience addiction will tell you it's not linear. It doesn't just go from either from not being an addict to an addict, and then not no longer being an addict. It is circular. It kind of folds back on itself. It's very entangled. So I wanted the storytelling mode to have this form of entanglement, where the multiplicity of languages constantly kind of folds back on itself, where fiction is informed by reality, and the reality is a form of telling fiction. And where, in a sense, the kind of traditional genre within filmmaking, so the big divide between documentary and fiction that is largely upheld by the film industry, is kind of subverted. And where we maybe try and find a new way of telling the story and a new way to address such a complex and difficult issue as addiction. So it really is about bringing form and content together in a way that perhaps produces some new ideas, presents some new insights on narratives that many people think they know. It's also, you know, in many films, traditionally, addiction or the use of drugs and alcohol is either vilified or glorified. You get these extremes. It's either this kind of, you know, the sort of traditional stories where it's either on one side or the other of the black and white fence. And I didn't want this dichotomy. I didn't want it to be either black and white and or good or bad. I wanted it to have all the kind of nuances of gray that comes when you constantly interrupt one train of thought, one kind of way of storytelling with another.
Boy. Yeah, I mean, addiction is one of those crazy things, right? I thought it's very interesting that within the film, when we were at one of the kind of recovery sessions, the lady's like, I hate labels. I hate to be looked at as just an addict. Right. And it's a very kind of profound thing, because no one likes a label. No one wants to be seen as just this, right? Just that. You want to be judged by your full body of who you are, right? The things you bring to the world, the things you do, right? But I kind of feel it's one of those things where it's just like you often get judged by the most destructive element of your personality, which can be addiction. But then you see these other, like, people that are addicted, but are completely functioning. It hasn't consumed them. So it is this very, just, I don't know, it's this compelling thing that I think, as you say, we usually see it in these two different forms, but it is so much more. So it's very interesting the fact that you did frame it like this, that it wasn't that, you know, Stephen or Thomas are villains necessarily, yeah. You know, we get to see who they are. Right. And that's interesting.
And I think, you know, if we think about all our personal, what we call identities, we are all multiple, you know, we're not just one person, this idea of a unified self, this kind of core essence that sort of sits somewhere in us, and that is the essence of being you, doesn't exist. It's a production. It's a fallacy. We are all multiple beings, and we all have multiple forms of producing senses of self towards the world that we encounter. We are very much kind of shaped by our environments and by the people. So I could often talk about locational and relational identities that we all produce constantly. And when making a film, of course, this idea of a production of identity and of characters is much more foregrounded. And when you have a film that is both a documentary and a fiction, it gives you this ability to kind of really play with this idea of character. And, you know, that people arguably in the film are always there as themselves when they speak in this roundtable discussion. And they do script read through, they're there supposedly as themselves, but they're also playing themselves.
Mm.
And they're working on a fiction role. So they are already constantly multiply there. So the line that is spoken by one of our support cast, Yvonne, I hate to be labeled, I'm so much more than just an addict. But that's what people see. That's what they want to see. It's such a poignant line. It's like one of the kind of like complete standout lines in the entire film. I'm glad you picked up on that. Because it sort of, in a sense, it sort of, in a nutshell, says, well, yes, you might have issues with addiction, so do many other people, but that's not the only thing you are. You are so much more than that. You are multiple. We all are. And the reasons why people have issues with addiction are also multiple and are really complex. And we all know that a lot of addiction is to do with pain relief, with having to cope with tremendously difficult situations, with trauma, with experiences that you can't process properly. And even though some of us might never experience addiction firsthand, I think a lot of people experience it at least secondhand. So whenever we've shown Stephen, people are quite often very moved because they know addiction in others and they've lived with addiction of others. And they know how difficult it is. And there is no such thing as, well, they could just stop. Well, they can't. Otherwise, they wouldn't be addicted.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult once something has gotten under your skin, whether it's a substance or something like gaming, gambling, our screen addictions. There's so many forms of addictions that are not necessarily always identified. And I think many, many of us are susceptible to them.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I think it was a couple of years ago. I think it was, you know, maybe in 2020. But I'm seeing a news article about, I think it was either a Japanese or a Chinese kid who died because they were addicted to computer games.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
They had just spent like a crazy amount of time just playing and they died. And it's just like, wait, what? Yeah. Like, you know, like there's certain addictions that you can kind of fathom, you know, drugs, alcohol, gambling, you know, like sex, you know, there's certain things that you go, okay, I can see how you could go down that rabbit hole. Mm. But then it's just like, but playing a game, you wouldn't conceive it because you just think, well, you have to get up to eat, you have to get up to you use the bathroom, you have to get up and move because you'll get cramped, it's uncomfortable. But you know, then you realize that this anything can grab hold of someone.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that you bring this up because there is now such an increase in gaming and gambling addictions, particularly since and the pandemic really exacerbated it, both on the level of economics and, you know, the austerity that has hit many people, the cost of living crisis, really, really hard, and which gives some people the kind of notion that if they could just gamble a tiny bit and augment the little money that they have. And once you're kind of in that spiral, it's really hard to come out because so much of it is online. It goes undetected.
Yeah.
And so much of it is also advertised towards vulnerable people to gamble more. And there's incentives to gamble more. And it's not regulated. And when I did research for the film, I was really quite shocked when you realize how pervasive gambling is and what devastating effects it can have. People who really become gambling addicts and lose so much and just, you know, in a sense, destroy their relationships, families, friendships. They end up completely on their own. And it's dangerous because in a lot of cases, it can lead to self-harm. It can lead, particularly in young men, it can lead to suicide. So the rate of suicide in young men has gone up exponentially. And, you know, the gambling industry is still largely deregulated. It's very intense. And because governments, again, kind of benefit in some ways from the gambling industry in terms of tax, the legislation and the change that needs to happen is so slow. So now there are gambling clinics across England, and some of them are, in fact, for underage gaming and gambling addicts aged 13 to 18. So, you know, you can imagine, I mean, it's a very serious problem for the NHS to open clinics for children to help them with their addiction. And once you have an addiction at such an early age, when your brain is still so malleable, it affects you for life.
Oh, for sure. It's
devastating to a lot of these young people. And I think what's really important, and again, you know, it's a film, it's a movie, it's an installation, it's an artwork, it's also a piece of activism. Mm. And I think that's really important, coming back to the kind of quote that you mentioned, I'm not an addict, I'm so much more than that. It really is important that addictions are destigmatized, because if we keep stigmatizing people that experience addictions, then there's no way forward. Then it's always those people over there, you know, the kind of the people that we don't really are. That it's not us. It's not my family. It's not my body. It's somewhere outside. And it's very convenient to kind of put it into the bracket of the other. But it's not the other. It's all of us. It's our societies. And we need to deal with the underlying symptoms and the causes that then lead to the pain, that then leads to addiction, if we want to kind of help people. This is not to say that people will not use alcohol or drugs or gamble in some way. We always have, and we always will do. You know, that's not to say we need to ban anything. In fact, that's counterproductive. And that's, again, it's about destigmatization and understanding the uses. There's been ritual use of drugs for as long as there's been humanity. So understanding it better and helping people better, that would be a real goal.
I mean, it's so much you've just said. So much you've just said. I mean, the gaming thing, because, I stopped playing games years ago because, you know, the font changed and I could not see what was going on. So I was just like, looks like I'm not playing games anymore. But which, you know, not probably not a bad thing, you know. But I hear there was this whole thing with loot crates, right? In-game purchases, which that trapped a lot of people. Because, you know, to advance, oh, if you buy this, you can get to the next level quicker. Oh, you can get this weapon, which will help you. And you can get this map. You can get, so there's all this, oh, I'll buy this and I'll buy this. And then you suddenly you've racked up, you know, hundreds, thousands of pounds of debt, you know, which they're getting. And as you said, I think a lot of these things get led off because of the money they can make for a government, right? It's not necessarily, you know, the money, you know, that thing can make, say, for the country, for the borough, for the state. A lot of times, these organizations help finance a politician's campaign. You know, so when there's all of this involved, why are people going to be like, no, we're banning that. We're putting a stop to that. And I'm just like, all right, let's just keep it going, you know? Because if you vilify the thing, right, if you vilify the addict, then it's their fault.
Yeah.
It's not these other things. It's them. They went too far. They couldn't control themselves. They're ill. They're weird. They're, you know, and it's this odd thing that we try and do. You know, it's just going, you're this, you're that, you're nothing else. You know, it's like when you look at things and it says, right, it's about redemption. You know, there's a way back from things, right? People go to jail and they go, no, look, people deserve a second chance. But you go to jail, trying to get a job from jail is a lot harder than if you hadn't been. So it's just like this supposed, you know, second chance, this supposed recovery, this redemption. It's not necessarily really there.
Mm.
So with the addicts, you know, like, yeah, we're putting this thing on people and it's hard to get that scarlet letter off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's important that we have things like Stephen that really help shine that light and show what this is, you know, the people who have gone through some of these things and are talking about it in these frank and honest ways. Which, how easy was that to get? You know, just like being able to have these people trust you to put that out in the world.
So in many ways, filmmaking holds a very special place potentially within kind of recovery processes. And that's something that I've discovered about 10 years ago when I made a previous work where I first met Stephen. I think filmmaking is a collective enterprise. It is by its nature. You know, you don't make films by yourself very rarely, particularly when they have a particular kind of scale. And filmmaking is known to be collaborative. It's people coming together to achieve this thing together. And that is very, very powerful. And one of the, again, sort of issues that I'm trying to talk about more is that the collective creativity of filmmaking can be incredibly powerful for people with mental health issues and people with addiction issues. Because when you come out of addiction, your sole focus, your passion, but also most likely your prime relation has been to an addiction, but also to the object attached to it, whether it's a bottle, a needle, a pack of cards, you know, that's your prime relationship. When you let that go, it causes a huge gap. You need something to fill this gap with. Mm-hmm. And all the people that I've worked with always say, you need something else. You need to have another passion and you need to develop another interest. If you don't have another interest at all, it's really difficult. So how did we work on Stephen? Well, we worked on it for a very long time. And I think the trust comes from investing time and really investing in people. So Stephen started as a series of workshops with a group of 16 people who are all people with addiction backgrounds. And the workshops were initially very private is probably the best way of putting it. We would have exercises, acting exercises, writing exercises, filming exercises, sound recording exercises. And we would work over a number of months of just working together in these kind of workshop settings, but it would never become public. It was just between us. We watched a lot of films together, films that have relevance, either because they deal with addiction directly or because they deal with compulsions and obsessions and passions, and that we watch together to form a common language so that we could then refer back to films. And I've done this over a number of different projects, and it's a really great way of sort of forming a sort of communal headspace, a bunch of research material that we all know together as a group. So once you kind of have a number of workshops where people increasingly become a bit braver, they tell stories because they know it's not going anywhere. It would never be made public. It's always just for us. Mm. They allow each other to be frank with each other and they build trust with each other. And then I and my team become included in that group. And you win people's respect because you're there and because you're really interested. I'm not pretending to be interested. I'm really interested and I really care. And these people have become very important to me. And they are still very important to me, even though Stephen is now finished. It exists. It goes out into the world. It gets released and on the 26th of April to cinemas. I'm in Copenhagen at a film festival at the moment. And we have two screenings here, which is amazing. So the film is finished. It's going into exhibitions, into museums. But the group of people is still attached to it. They now become my collaborators again, in going and doing Q&As for the film, in presenting the film to other communities, in being actively involved in the distribution of the film. So to say to people from the beginning, this is a long journey we're going on together, and we'll all be involved with the various stages of this film. And they're not just there to kind of like turn up one day, speak a few lines and go home again. They're really attached. Mm. And they know that this attachment to the film is genuine. And that they are really cared for through the group, through us as a production team, And through, in a sense, through the community that we've built around the making of the film. So it gives them a platform to speak. The one thing that I always say to people, and we do, again, so quite a lot of, quite a lot of dialogue and conversation around this, is like, there's certain stories that people tell that I would say to them, it's really generous of you to tell the story. I don't think it should be in the film. And I'm not sure it should be necessarily be made public. You might feel right now that you're happy to share it, but once the film goes out, and once, so there's also various stages of veto rights that are built into the whole process of reviewing the material. But once the film is made public, even if I wanted to, I can't call it back because it's already been out there. So certain stories that are really traumatic or difficult or intensely personal, we then look at over and over. And I say to people, look at, you know, you might want to reconsider. We filmed it. I give you the material, but I don't think we should put it in the film. I don't think we should make this public. This is for you to kind of think through, but maybe not for the world to necessarily see and hear. So there's a lot of consultation. People see the material, whatever we filmed. They have very strong rights over the material, and they see it like at least 6 months in, like at various stages in the edit, but at least 6 months before anything goes public. So they can then say, this, I'm really happy with this, I'd rather not be seen, and we can then withdraw it. So they can also feel confident that they are not exposing themselves unnecessarily.
That is, I mean, you should be applauded for that. That's such a nice thing, because the amount of times I've heard stories where, you know, a documentary's been filmed and then it's gone out in the world, and then the subject of it is just like, I didn't want that part to be out there. Like, I wish they hadn't put that part out there. I remember there was a documentary about a UFC fighter. She won the Ultimate Fighter, this lady, I forget her name. It was a few years ago, and there was a documentary made about her. And in the documentary, there's some nudity. I can't remember what exactly happened, if she, in a fight, her top came up, or if they kind of were filming as she was changing or something, but there was nudity, which she didn't know. And then the documentary went out, and then suddenly she's like, wait, hold on. But no one had run that past her, which was crazy. And she had to take them to court to try and get it removed. But like, once it's out, it's out. And they might get a restraining on it and have to edit it out, but there will now be versions of that still out in the world, you know? So
yeah, I mean, the moment it's out, someone downloads it, refilms it, takes a photograph off a screen, you know, it's out, even if it's then afterwards. Now, I'm really, I think that's the responsibility of all of us who make work with real people in the real world, and who these people trust us. They're very generous. They trust us with their stories, with their life, with their bodies, with their gestures, with their face. And that trust needs to be earned, and it needs to be respected. And I think there's increasingly a great deal of ethical thinking around documentary making that pertains to the fact that people, the subjects of films, need to be protected.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's a great thing, you know. And yeah, I think it just endears people to want to work with you more, right? Because, you know, you've shown that level of trust and humanity, you know. So I think it's just it's a good thing, an important thing.
It is, you know, in a very genuine way. I'm not a, even though, you know, as an artist, quite often we're seen as being these kind of soul fighters or authors. I work really collaboratively. I don't believe that all the good ideas grow in my head on their own. They come through conversations, they come through exchange, they come through working with other people. And, you know, if other people are so generous to contribute to this project that I want to make, then I think the least you need to do is kind of honor their contribution, their generosity. And yeah, I love working with people. I mean, it's the biggest joy in my life is to bring a group of people together and to achieve something together. I mean, it's the best feeling in the world.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, working with people is great. It's the thing, right? When you go to a press screening, right? You've gone to a press screening, you've watched the film, and you come out, I always want to have a conversation. But a lot of times, everyone's just, you know, in their, they've got things to do, they've gone. So you rarely get the opportunity to talk to people about it. And then there's that thing where it's just like, I want to talk to the people that created this because I'm so interested about that shot. Like, what was the idea to do it like that? I've never seen this done before. So having the opportunity to talk to you and talk to other directors and writers and actors, that is always such a fantastic component of this because it's just fascinating, right? And even if, right, you've watched, like, there could be another documentary that I have to watch tomorrow, say, that deals with addiction, but it's not going to be the same as Stephen. And that's great. There's so many times you will watch something, horrors, rom-coms, you know, but it's always different. Like, because it's some that this is someone's interpretation of what this would be, what this looks like. It looks different to everyone. So that's always just fascinating.
I think also, you know, all of us as filmmakers, artists, musicians, writers, we contribute to an ongoing dialogue and an ongoing conversation within a given medium. And, you know, I think we all hope that we make a valuable contribution to this dialogue and to this conversation, and that it propels the conversations somehow forward, that there is, that we can come up with new ideas that speak to the notion of filmmaking. Yes, there's the content and there's subject matter, but there's also the form of filmmaking that I think each filmmaker contributes to and thinks through. You know, filmmakers are, I mean, the beauty of filmmaking is that it is so, it has this kind of multiplicity. It has obviously images and movement and sound and time and dialogue and story, but also, you know, so it's a very, very rich medium in the sense that you can work on so much detail across all these different layers that then create what we call a film. But there's also, you know, we all strive to make some formal innovations and contributions to the medium to then, you know, go forward from that slightly changed and slightly reinvented. And, you know, all the great filmmakers strive to make films that haven't been quite made like this before. So, you know, we think long and hard about the history of film. And I think a lot of film is also about the history of film, the history of this medium, and how the various components that then make up what we call a movie have been put together in the past and how we might put them together slightly differently to reinvent what the medium can do.
Really true, really true. You know, coming from a visual art background, what was it that kind of made you think to yourself, you know what, I could work in this medium as well? I feel I can tell stories in this other way.
So I studied photography at the Royal College of Art many years ago and worked photographically probably for the first almost 10 years after leaving the Royal College. And I think my work is still really strongly influenced by photography, the way I think and the way I compose images, even in a moving image camera, is very photographic. But partly because maybe I was trained within photography and I know the medium really well, there's some of the things that are kind of the almost like the ontology of a photograph are also what to me can be slight frustrations, which is this intense reduction of the multiplicity of life into one moment, which is the condensation of the photograph, which is what makes it so powerful. that this very image now stands for everything that went on around it, both temporally and in terms of the geography around this image. So a photograph is always this kind of this cutout slice of space and time, which yes. is, again, that's its power. That's the phenomenal intensity of a photograph. And eventually, I think from about 2000, I realized that I think it's more than anything the different relationship to time that the moving image has to the photograph. So the photograph has, its, you know, that's a very, very rehearsed argument that the photograph by definition is past, that it has a very strong relationship to something that, you know, there has been, there's a moment of death in the moment of the photograph being taken because that moment is forever gone. And it's also, you know, it's this very particular kind of decision-making that is reduced to quite often a 60th of a second. Whereas duration for me holds so many opportunities to speak with a slightly longer breath. So it's like, you know, the kind of, it kind of allows you to be a little bit more in gesture, in movement, and present over a longer exhalation than a photograph will ever allow us to do. So I never set out, so it wasn't so much a decision that like, oh, maybe I should make a film, as ideas that crystallized at the time, so about maybe 15, 20 years ago, needed to have duration. They didn't work as a photograph. So then I started to make the first video work, and I thought, that's really interesting. I really enjoyed having sound. I love working with sound. I quite often write soundtracks to video art pieces that are shown within sort of gallery museum settings. And even though I still make photographs, I would definitely say I'm more of a video artist and filmmaker now than a photographer.
Right. Yeah, I like photos. When I'm taking a photo, I call it like an action shot. I don't like as you know, be like, okay, let's gather around, stop. And I like to just roam around and then take a picture as people are talking or doing something. My friends hate it. They hate it because sometimes, you know, there's this, when you get the picture, so it's like this weird expression on the face. But I love it because it's just like, you know, it's this moment of time. But when you see it in that form, you'd be like, oh gosh, you just told a joke, or you were just saying this thing. And it just invokes so much more for me than just that still posed orchestrated shot, you know?
I mean, so that's we could talk for a few hours about the kind of relationship between still moving images and photography, and how photography is changing so drastically. And, you know, as a medium, it is no longer what it was even 10 years ago. So, but yeah, that's a whole nother, that's a whole nother podcast.
Oh, man. Yeah, I wouldn't mind having that conversation, to be honest. Something else that was very striking about Stephen was the dancer. And I, you know, I'm watching it and I couldn't necessarily get the relationship, but as a visual medium, as a visual form, it was very fascinating. And it was also this kind of break from this, you know, relenting, you know, conversation around addiction, which is important, but you're just like, oh, that's nice. You know what I mean? We get these flowing movements and this freedom, which was interesting, because it's like everyone's talking about addiction and it's kind of like this cage that has trapped these people. But then the movement of the dancer is the freedom. And it's so, like, I was just like, I don't know why she's there, but I like it. I'm enjoying this, you know? So, yeah, what was the idea of that in the film?
So it's interesting that you pick up on this. And it is The dancing is there for a number of different reasons, but it really happened quite organically because two of the people in the group, one of the dancers is the young woman who says the line that you picked out earlier on about hating to be labeled. And the other one, Rachel, is playing a role in the pub. She's the pub landlady. And the two of them, to me, are incredible people in real life. They also are great on camera. And in some ways, I wanted to have them on camera more. And I know that they both love dancing. So it was really started as an idea that I thought, well, what would happen if they were to dance in the middle of the night, in the street, around the locations where a lot of the other kind of walking scenes take place, and just ask them to dance? And it was an experiment. So I asked them whether they'd be up for that. They're both brilliant dancers, and they both dance a lot, but also they sort of feel it's a mode of expression for them. It's a way of speaking. And they speak eloquently in words, but they speak very eloquently through their bodies. And so on a very windy Liverpool night in January or February, we asked them to come out and we filmed a number of different dance scenes with them and in locations that are also otherwise in the film. So it's kind of same street corners. And even at the time when they were doing it, it felt really powerful. It felt like it had this, I don't know, this emotional sensibility that, I mean, that in a sense doesn't need words. I just found it really powerful how their bodies express so much of their experience, their being in as real people, but also being in the film and trusting the film as a container for their being. And so we filmed it, and then it was in and out of the edit. And in the end, I felt it was also serving a function as making space in between these other sort of quite dense moments, and for there to be nonverbal moments, moments that are still carrying some of the messages and senses and also visual qualities of the film, but without words. So these kind of nonverbal interjections that, give a bit of breath to the film.
Yeah, it's kind of like a visual aperitif, as it were. Which, yes. It was like, why nighttime?
So that's the other reason. So the dance also happens within the film when it very clearly sort of indicates time passing. So the first time, apart from the intro, which is sort of like this, the sort of collage of scenes, It happens when Thomas Goody has entered the kind of the undercover and underground poker den, and they're playing. And as a way of kind of indicating that time is passing, we almost, they're sitting there, they're smoking, they're waiting for Max, the money shark, to turn up. And as a way to indicate that time just continues, we, as in like the camera, steps outside and finds these kind of, it's almost like they're like sirens dancing in the night. So in these kind of solitary figures who are just dancing in nondescript spaces. And then we return back into the underground poker den with something else having happened in between, which sort of says time has passed. Mm. So, and nighttime dancing and people dancing alone at night in the street is quite special. It's beautiful, it's magical, it's a little bit surreal. But it's also a way of reclaiming space, particularly for women and women at night. So it was really important that both of them were women and that they're dancing on their own in the street at night as a form of claiming that space.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I wondered, but that's fascinating. Now, I believe that it's also an art installation. So was that always, when you envisioned making this, was it always like, oh, and we could extend it into this form as well? Or what? When did that come to you?
It was always intended to be both a piece of cinema, a movie that would play in cinemas, but also an installation that would have a place in a different shape in exhibitions. And I've never done this before, so it's new to me too, to work across the two different ways of presentation and distribution. And I think it works incredibly well because it also plays to very different audiences. So in, you know, the film ultimately is, in the first instance, a movie. It belongs on a big screen. That's how it's best seen and heard, with like amazing surround sound. But when it's an exhibition, it's across two rooms where we build a small cinema in one room, and then in the first room have a multi-channel installation that is completely dedicated to the support cast. Because Stephen is in every single scene, and he carries the film on his broad shoulders.
Mm.
But also, you know, it really circulates around him as a person and his fictional character. So we're with Stephen and or Thomas Goody the whole time. And in the installation in the first room, there's a 5-channel multi-channel installation on, you know, old-fashioned TV style screens, a 2-channel and a single channel. And it's just a support cast preparing and going through the process of getting ready to make the film. So that you see them auditioning, you see them going through costume fittings, you see them going into character and talking about themselves from a third position. So they getting closer and closer to really inhabiting their character. So it's all about process. So in the installation, you have a slightly different experience of the work. And what's really beautiful is that the film, in terms of its cinematic presence, it gets released on the 26th of April. And from the 3rd of May, we're starting an exhibition tour where the installation will be shown in Cornwall at a place called The Exchange. And we'll run there from May through to November. So it also means that in particular places, the work will have a much longer duration. It can sit there for a long time, you know, beyond the kind of cinematic release, and reach different audiences.
Fascinating. Huh. How hard was that to get that buying, though? Because I think you can have the idea, but then you have to visit, you know, one of the two difficult things a lot when talking to, you know, directors, producers,
yeah,
is financing and distribution, right? So that's just for one film, but you've got a film and an installation. So what are the difficulties of getting that buy-in to be able to be like, oh, can we then have this installation for, you know, a duration? Because, you know, there's places that might go, oh yeah, we can have it for a week, you can have it, but, you know, for a nice duration of time.
I think coming from a background as a visual artist, I'm probably, a lot of my audience is within the visual art, and I know some of the visual art spaces, museums, public galleries. And so the conversation started, particularly since the work launched at the Liverpool Biennial, and it was there as an installation. So a lot of people got to see it. I know of other curators and gallery directors, museum directors got to see it there. So there was some interest quite quickly to show it again and for the installation to go on tour. And unfortunately, we've got an amazing distributor for the cinematic release, so that the two run in parallel. I mean, it's very fortunate that that's working out at the moment. But I do feel it's kind of a model that I want to work with more, so that that works can, particularly if they're feature length, sit within the kind of cinematic context, because it's an amazing immersive experience to go into cinema and see it, but it can also have another life as an installation.
Yeah, and all I think also as an installation, you can have more conversations. You know, because when you're watching a film, you can't talk, right? Mm-hmm. And as I said, a lot of times people have put aside a certain pocket of time. Right, we've got 2 hours, let's go and do this thing. So when you leave, still not necessarily always having those conversations, but in an art installation, when you go to a gallery, that's kind of the place for conversations. You know, it's always fascinating walking around and being like, yo, what do you see when you look at that? You know what I mean? What does that talk to you? How does that talk to you? Like, you know what I mean? It's for that. So yeah, you're able to extend this conversation around, you know, addiction and labeling and just all of these different kind of, you know, mental health, these other themes, which is very interesting.
Yeah. And it sort of places more responsibility on the viewer to make decisions about how they navigate the space. You get to your seat, you sit in that seat, you stay there, and that's your position, and then the film unfolds in front of you. In an installation, there's still screening times of the film, but it's your decision whether you kind of, you know, see the installation elements first, then you go and see the screening, or you see the screening first and come back out and see the installation elements. So the way you then, in a sense, put the pieces together is left to the viewer's responsibility.
Yeah. That is a really good idea. Have you made any connections with the government or addiction organizations to be able to, again, extend this kind of life?
Absolutely. We're talking to quite a lot of addiction organizations to take the film to recovery centers. So it's really important for the whole project that there's what's called an impact strategy around it. So we take it to different recovery centers around the country, particularly when there's exhibitions, there's a big outreach project that will then take it to the local recovery community, where people might not necessarily come to a gallery or a screening or a cinema, but we take the film to them and do events, conversations, workshops, and screenings for people in those communities.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because the, you know, back in the day, cinema was like, you know, the cheap date. Now it's not. Now cinema is pretty expensive. And also going to a gallery, right? It can be expensive, you know. So that's fantastic that you're, you know, you've got that opportunity to take it to people. Absolutely. Who could definitely benefit from, you know, seeing people who are going through what they're going through, but have also come out the other side as well.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, no, that's very, you know, one thing that I always find fascinating about addiction is the things we deem are addiction, right? Because there's other things people do and they'll be like, oh, they're a collector. But you know, but if you do this thing, you know, you can be a whiskey collector, but then someone else that drinks just more of it, now they're an addict. It's it's fascinating. It's definitely a fascinating thing. But this was such an interesting piece of work, as I said. It was just the visual aspect of it was just gripping, you know, the different hues that you used, you know, just the night elements, the day elements, the dancing, just all of these different things. And then, you know, you've got Stephen, hi, I'm Stephen Gibbons and I'm auditioning as Thomas Gibbons. Goody. And then it's like, I'm Thomas Gibbons. It's that blurring of the lines. Right. So you're watching this just really interesting thing, and everyone in it, really great acting as well. So yeah, all the components just work so well. So huge congratulations to the piece.
Thank you. Well, it extends to all the people who've worked with me. Thank you very much.
Oh, no problem at all. No, I'm just really happy that I got an opportunity to see it. So yeah, I'm sure when it drops on the 26th that, man, people are going to definitely be impacted by this piece of work.
I hope it'll get to reach a lot of people on that it finds its audience out in the world.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it will. I mean, do you have your next project in mind?
Yeah, I'm working on two more feature films. So watch this space. I've got a taste for them now. So yes,
definitely. Okay, well, when they're ready, when you're ready to talk about them, I hope you will come back and we can have another conversation, because that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. No, where can people find you?
So they can find me through my website. Very simple, my name. And there's only one person with my name, so it's very easy to find me. The film Stephen will be distributed through a wonderful distributor called Modern Films, and all the screenings will be on Modern Films' website. There is a category for Stephen, and all the screenings will be announced there. On the 25th of April, we're having a preview at the Barbican, and the booking link for that will be open soon. It's not quite live yet, but will be soon. And then it'll come to cinemas near you, and hopefully also exhibitions near you. So hopefully people can find the film fairly easily.
Awesome. And will it go international? The installation aspect of it.
So at the moment, obviously I'm in Copenhagen at the moment, here at the film festival. We have some invitations and conversations with some other film festivals. And in terms of the installation, it'll tour the UK first, and then we'll have to see whether we can take it international as well.
Tremendous. Oh, well, that's superb. So people, all the links will be on the website, so make sure you go and check that out. Follow Melanie, because, you know, there's a lot there, and it sounds like we got even more greatness coming, so you don't want to miss out. And yeah, go see Stephen. It's just so compelling. So Melanie, thank you so much for the film, and thank you even more for your time.
It's thank fantastic. You for the conversation. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Ah, well, I'm glad. Thank you. All right, have a wonderful time in Copenhagen, and enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Take care.
All right. Bye. Bye. So there you have it, people. Stephen was fascinating to watch, and Melanie was just so engaging, right? It was so just intriguing hearing about, you know, how she started and how this whole fictional, you know, true life documentary hybrid thingy just came about, right? So if you want to see it, and I'm sure you do, it's you know, going on the road from the 26th of April, right? So yeah, it hits the Barbican on the 25th, and then from the 26th it's going to be playing all across London, different, you know, screenings with Q&As, and then it's going around the country. So I'll put a few of those links on my site. You can go to Modern Films as well for more screening information, right, which will be constantly updated, so always make sure you check that out. Follow them, you know, follow Melanie and everyone else via Insta and their socials, and I hope you enjoyed it, people, because that was another fantastic conversation. Remember, in part one, right, we looked at Blackberry, Rebel Moon, right, The Scar Giver. We looked at Prey, Land of Bad, and Cold. So a lot of interesting films, people. Make sure you go check that out. Go watch us on YouTube and share with your friends. All right, I will see you next week for more great films and conversations. All right, people, until then. Peace.